at a normal hour. And please feel free to take bagels and pastries and enjoy them. My name is Dina Burkett. I am the Senior Associate Director of Alumni Affairs at YU, which is really just a long-winded way of saying I get to plan a lot of really great programs and get to know our alumni, and this is one of them, and we're very excited to be here today and to welcome Dr. Jill Katz. For those of you who have been to these lectures recently, in the past, David Huggins used to run these, and unfortunately, David left Yeshiva University last week, but fortunately for me, that means that I get to be here and meet all of you, so thank you so much for being here. And like I said, thank you to Dr. Katz, who is joining us today as our presenter. Dr. Katz teaches archaeology and anthropology at Yeshiva University with a specialty in biblical archaeology. Dr. Katz has excavated at several sites in Israel, including Ashkelon, Tel Haror Gerar, and most recently Tel Esafi Gat, which she was actually just talking about, where she currently serves as area supervisor for Area P. Her research interests focus on the nature of Israelite leadership during the time of the Judges and on emergent urban life during the time of King David. And so we'd like to welcome Dr. Katz.
Thank you. All right. I guess I can stand. Get the blood going here. Still, you'll be happy to know, actually, at Yeshiva University, we still don't start classes before 9 a.m. So this is about 20 minutes too early for me here. So since it's the Hanukkah season upon us, I thought that's what we would do. We would kind of, you know, go back 2,000 years, 2,100 years, and almost 2,200 years now, and talk about that. And also try to present a slightly, maybe a little bit different way of thinking about what exactly triggered the rebellion and why it became sort of essential that the Jews rebel. I mean, in general, I'm not a big fan of Jews rebelling. I think that we've had, you know, disastrous consequences as a result. So the rebellions against Rome, complete disaster. Bar Kokhba rebellion, you know, what were they thinking? There was no way they were going to take down the Roman Empire. But in this case, I mean, maybe hindsight's 2020, where of course the results were good for us. This was a good rebellion, and we'll see why, because I'm going to frame it a little bit in terms of a bureaucratic decision. But we'll start at the beginning, which of course is the Hanukkah story, is one of religious persecution and factional tensions. And then also an interesting question came up, which for the first time in history that the Jews were really confronted with, which was, how much to embrace a secular culture. I mean, it's, you know, obviously this isn't the first encounter Jews have with a larger culture or an empire, but the Greek culture was the first secular culture, and also it was one where they actively promoted sort of the conquered peoples adopting their culture. So we'll get back to that. And then the last area, which maybe is one that you hadn't thought about before, is the bureaucratic decisions that were so harmful to Judaism, and that's why basically the Jews were forced to rebel in order to preserve something that they had established that was essential to Jewish continuity when we no longer had political autonomy. So we'll get to all of that. All right, so now just a point on anti-Semitism. Of course, Christians did not invent anti-Semitism. It actually predates Christianity. Of course, you know, you have the, you know, Paro and Haman, who, you know, perceived Jews as fifth columns, so it was kind of seen as sort of in national terms. And then there's the Greek historian who lived in Egypt, Manetho, and he sort of rewrote he's the one who kind of rewrote the history of Egypt, and he talks about. And by this time, by the way, by the Greek period, he was a priest and a historian. If they knew anything about Jews, the one thing that was well known about Jews in the Greek world was the story of the Exodus, the story that Jews told, that they had been slaves in Israel. This was something that, if you kind of only knew one thing about Jews, that was the one thing that you knew. And so he deals with that because he's writing the history of Egypt, and from a kind of a more biased Egyptian perspective, and he throws out the idea that actually it wasn't the Jews who are going to escape for freedom, etc. Rather, the Egyptians kick them out, and he ties them even to the Hyksos a little bit, but then they're kicked out because they're a diseased element, and they have to be kicked out in order to preserve Egyptian, you know, safety and integrity, and even describes them as lepers. So that's just kind of, you know, so it's just sort of nice to know that we've been hated for longer than we thought. And then, of course, Christianity takes a different tack, which, again, when you think about, when we think about the Greek approach, realize this is pre-Christian. So the Christian anti-Semitism, which is rooted in sort of a religious perspective of Jews having, you know, rejected Jesus and of course, the big one, that we killed him. This is not something that's in the consciousness, obviously, of the Syrian Greeks. So just by that as by way of background. So the building up to the story of Hanukkah. So you have Alexander conquering kind of the world and around the year 333 BCE. And when he conquers the Persian Empire, he actually then, you know, gets all the lands that the Persians had previously controlled. The Jews actually did well under the Persians, and we'll come back to that in a moment, but it was not something that the Jews immediately embraced, because life under the Persians was actually really good. The Jewish community had the opportunity to, you know, Cyrus was the great redeemer, the Jews had gone back to the land of Israel, rebuilt the Beit HaMikdash, and while they didn't have political autonomy, they had religious autonomy, and I'll come back to that. But and life was kind of going along swimmingly. You had, you know, the idea that, you know, the Jews were really governing themselves religiously, and as far as politically, as long as they paid their taxes, they were kind of left alone. So there was not an initial embrace of the Greeks simply for that reason. And then what happened was, after Alexander died, you had fighting between his successors who would control the land of Israel. So the prize was not Jerusalem. I mean, for us, of course, Jerusalem is the center of the world. But for the rest of the world, you have to realize Jerusalem is not on a major trade route at all. It's in the hills. It's kind of far from things. The main trade route was ran through the coastal plain. And then there was another important trade route in Jordan that was the King's Highway. So you had the Via Maris going up the coastal plain, and you had the King's Highway in Transjordan. So, and the other thing is, Jerusalem is not on a major body of water. So these are partially related, but, you know, it's, you know, when you think of great cities of the ancient world, you know, Rome or Athens or something, they're always on like a great body of water. And here, you know, you just, the only perennial source of water in Jerusalem, of course, is the spring, the Gihon, which is fine. It provides enough water for the people, but it's not, you know, sort of this great body of water where you're going to have, you know, traders coming and a harbor and that type of thing. So it wasn't Jerusalem that was on the mind, but what the Greeks wanted was the very profitable trade routes that ran from Egypt to Mesopotamia to Phoenicia up towards Turkey, and that was the coastal route. So that was one reason to try to fight over this piece of land. And originally, it was supposed to go to the Seleucids, who were based in Antioch, which is in Syria. But the Ptolemies in Egypt kind of seized it, and the Syrian Greeks didn't really put up a fight. They never relinquished their claim to the land, but they're like, all right, fine, we're not gonna. It should be ours. You're taking it right now. One day, you know, it'll come back to us. So the Ptolemies had control over the land of Israel, and the Jews who were living in the land of Israel then, from the the 3rd century. Again, the Ptolemies didn't really interfere too much in things, and so they were sort of left to the way traditional practices had been. And moreover, by being sort of removed, not being on the coastal area, Greek culture, it kind of took a while before it spread to Jerusalem. So it wasn't an immediate thing. You know, Alexander comes in and all of a sudden we're all Greek. It really took about a century for it to sort of make its way to Jerusalem. When you start finding Jews having some Greek names, and, you know, traditional Jews with Greek names. So that it takes a while. And then around the end of the 3rd century, so around 200, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids are engaged in some fighting, and the Seleucids seize the land of Israel, which they claimed had been theirs all along. And so you have this transition from the Ptolemaic Greeks to the Seleucid Greeks. And so that's kind of the preamble to our stories, because now you're dealing with the Seleucids. And also, Jews were not immune to that sort of factionalism between the two Greeks, and there were some Jews that aligned themselves with the Ptolemies and some Jews that aligned themselves with the Syrian Greeks. So when the Ptolemies were on top, those Jews were on top, and when the Ptolemies went down, they went down. And so the famous family associated with the Ptolemies, of course, was the Tobias, the Tobiads. And the credit is given to Joseph Tobiad, who was the tax collector for the Ptolemies in that area. He was given the concession, so he's considered sort of the first Jewish banker ever. And then the Onias, who was the Kohen Gadol, his family was aligned with the Syrians. And so when they came into power, sort of the Tobiads went down and the Onaiads went up as far as power goes, vis-a-vis. So Antiochus the Fourth, who's the villain, obviously, in our story here, the one thing that the Greeks never really got was kind of how the Jewish religious practice, they didn't understand it at all. I mean, some of it was just abhorrent to them. I mean, the idea that, you know, circumcision was, they could never wrap their hands around that one. They didn't understand the dietary laws. I mean, the basic principle was completely foreign, which is for Jews, it's all about, you know, God's covenant with the family, right? With one family, and that's separate from the rest of the world, right? We're the chosen people. There's the non-chosen people. And then everything we do sort of reifies this idea that there's some things that are particular that are okay and other things that are not okay. So the laws of kashrut, it's not just some random thing. It's that there's some foods that you can eat and some that you can't. And that mimics the whole concept of, you know, this exclusivity that there's God's chosen people, etc. And so everything was about sort of exclusivity. And that got played out on the Temple Mount, which was, of course, is that not everyone was invited into the Beit HaMikdash. And you had, even within the sacred space, there were areas where you had increasing exclusivity. So you had a place where, you know, at a place where on the outside where, like, non-Jews could go. You had places where, you know, like, women and slaves could go. You had other places where Israelite men could go. And then only where the Kohanim and the Levim could go, and then only where the Kohen Gadol could go. So there was this increasing exclusivity, which was completely foreign to the Hellenistic way of thinking. I mean, a Hellenistic temple was open to everybody. And also the way that they approached religion was like, if they conquered new peoples, they sort of recognized, okay, you have your chief male deity, we have our chief male deity, you have your chief female deity. And they sort of fused together. There was no problem with sort of merging deities into things. So, you know, the Phoenician god Baal, he could be associated with Zeus. You know, they would just take on those kinds of characteristics. And again, there wasn't anything exclusive about it. It was there was a lot of syncretism, and everything kind of fit in without anybody asking too many questions. So this concept, though, of sacred space that is defined and limited, they never really got, except the fact that somehow they were upsetting it. But they had no respect for it because it was just such a foreign concept. And so he, you know, makes some movements on the Temple Mount that are just something that for Jews, you know, was so magnified and so horrible. But the truth is, he didn't really, like, it didn't resonate with him. He didn't realize, oh, I'm doing this. I mean, he saw the reaction, but it wasn't something that resonated with him, going, oh my goodness, I'm stepping here and I'm not supposed to. You know, it was just a very, very different way of thinking. So, and then he got caught up into certain Jewish factionalism that began to arise. So these are the days that before sort of the big three that we know from the Second Temple period of the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Essenes. This era predates that, but we start to see the factions already emerging. So you have those Jews who fully want to embrace Hellenism. They embrace it for all sorts of, all the opportunities it can offer, as well as they like the culture. And those are called the, they're often referred to as the Antiochian Jews, because the capital of the Seleucids is Antioch in Syria. And in fact, they even had a new name for Jerusalem, which was supposed to be called Antioch in Judea. That was kind of their new name for the city. So this was a small group, but pretty influential, and even some of the Kohanim and the Kohen Gadol was often associated with this group. Okay, so it was a pretty small, influential group that saw the economic benefits of really embracing Hellenism and raising the status. And it all gets played out in Jerusalem and in the status of Jerusalem. So to really be a full citizen in the Greek world, you had to live in what was known as an official polis, right? So that was a city that had sort of sanctioned status as a real city. And in order to become a polis, you had to have certain institutions, right? Just like today, if you want to be a real city, you know, you have to have the city hall, and you have to have the courthouse, and you have to have a baseball stadium, and I don't know, a pound where you tow cars away, but you have to have certain institutions. And so there actually, there was official sort of guidelines that in order to reach that level of polis, which had certain tax advantages, you had to have a theater, you had to have a gymnasium, you had to have a marketplace, the agora, an acropolis. You had to have sort of this whole series of things. And so they aspired to that. Now, it's a slow process. It wasn't something that could happen overnight, because these are a lot of buildings that have to be constructed. But so there was that group. And they sort of got very attached to Antiochus and used him to sort of help them out in their cause. And so he sort of also, whatever he was doing, he was being fed information by this group, and he sort of became, you know, he got caught up in the politics among the Jews, which then has sort of serious ramifications. Now the second middle group was actually very much associated with the regular Kohanim, but it included sort of the middle class, you know, merchants and traders, that type of thing. And these were people who did embrace Hellenism up to a point, and again, also appreciated the economic benefits that went along with that, but were zealous in maintaining the purity of the Beit HaMikdash and the whole Temple Mount area, because these are the Kohanim. This is their job. They have no interest in putting themselves out of a livelihood. They were very attached and dedicated to the practice that took place on the Temple Mount. They weren't interested in reforming it, nothing like that, but in other aspects. So, you know, Josephus talks about how, you know, the Kohanim would go and they would do their job at the temple, and then, you know, the gong would go off when their shift was over, and then they would go run, you know, to the gymnasium or whatever, and part. So they were sort of, they embraced it up to a point. And then there was the third, kind of the larger group, which was everybody else, who were very much opposed to Hellenism and to what it stood for and to any kind of compromise that would take place with that. So those are your three groups. And then you have Antiochus sort of falling, you know, playing into this and not really being sensitive to you know, Jewish concerns, and not realizing that what he was doing was going to upset the stability of the region, because if you're a ruler, that's actually should be one of your chief goals, of course, is maintaining stability. So he wasn't such a great ruler in that regard. All right, so the first thing he does, so at the behest, actually, of the, you know, the Antioch Jews, he gets involved in the first real religious persecution in history, which is when he outlaws, right, Brit Milah and Shabbat observance, and he outlaws the Kashrut laws, and then he takes it to the Temple Mount. So they remove the walls from the Temple Mount, and then he does something, again, which is a complete violation of Jewish practice, which is he plants trees up there on the platform, and not so. But the reason for the trees is that from a Greek perspective, you're sort of recreating. This is something very popular at Greek sites, which is the sacred grove. So the idea was that he wanted to sort of refashion it, and he had the support of the most Hellenized Jews to refashion this Jewish temple into sort of a pagan temple, a Greek temple, which was the sacred grove. And another thing to keep in mind is the most Hellenized Jews also saw this as an opportunity to purify, to reform, I should say, their Judaism of sort of rabbinic influence. Like, they saw it then as going back to some earlier, you know, Abrahamic type of faith where you just had a bama and you didn't have all of these rules and rituals and regulations that had developed sort of over the centuries. And so it was transforming of that sacred space that you know, seems to have led to the basically turning that middle group against the Greeks. So we always knew that the rest of the people who were completely opposed were opposed to the group. But it was that middle influential group that at that point begins to turn. But that alone is not enough to really cause the rebellion.
It's ironic that we have trees up there today.
Well, yeah, but we didn't plant those.
Still have that situation.
Right. That's true, and I think it's, and that was specifically done not for the sacred grove concept, but because it's against Jewish tradition to have trees up there. And that was a deliberate move on the part of the Muslims to put the trees up there.
And it would be against our tradition to have trees in the entire platform area or only in the sacred space?
Actually, I think our tradition is not to have any trees on the Temple Mount at all. Now, the Temple Mount has been enlarged over the years. So, you know, whether or not that level of sanctity applied to the parts where, you know, Herod expanded, not 100% sure. But I do believe that during Herodian times, for example, when he expanded the Temple Mount, there were no trees up there, for sure. And that was the Jewish tradition. Yeah. So that's deliberate, not an accident that there's trees up there. So when that happened, when they put up, I'll tell you exactly where it is. It says that on the 15th of the day of Kislev, which is probably, what is today? It's probably around now, right? It's pretty close. I think maybe we're a little past it. We're at the 18th of Kislev, 17th, 18th. All right. So a couple days ago, they erected, it uses the word for an abomination, but it was probably a matzeva or something was put up there on the Temple Mount. That's in the first book of Maccabees.
Can you tell us the status, just quickly, the historical veracity of Maccabees?
Oh.
What do scholars think?
Yeah. Oh, so the first book, so the two books were not written at the same time. The first book of Maccabees was probably originally written in Hebrew, although we don't have any of the original Hebrew copies. It was translated as part of the Septuagint, And so we have the Greek translation of the Book of Maccabees, but based on the language and the style, it seems that the Greek is a translation of the of an original Hebrew text. It's a very, you know, seems, I mean, if you read it, it's a lot of, especially at the first two chapters are kind of a little more interesting. Later on, it just talks, I mean, the war drags on for a long time, and so it gives the accounts of every single battle that takes place, and you see as Matityahu's sons, like, you know, as they get killed, then the new one has to come in and become the ruler, because it's a long, drawn-out battle, and there's a lot of bloodshed and a lot of change of leadership. So the authenticity is generally considered pretty reliable. I mean, not, you know, 100%, as I'm sure it has its biases, but between the Book of Maccabees, now the second Book of Maccabees, I'll say, that was probably originally written in Greek and was written later and has been argued that it's a little more polemical and written from the perspective of the Hashmonaim trying to kind of solidify their position there. Because there were some issues with Hashmonaim right from the beginning, which of course is that as Kohanim, which no one doubts, but they're not supposed to be the kings. And so that, you know, there was always some doubt as to their legitimacy. And so the second Book of Maccabees does a little bit more as trying as a little bit more propaganda in that sense to try to buttress their claim. So it wasn't included in the canon. Right, it wasn't. In fact, it is preserved, I think, in the Apocrypha does preserve the Book of Maccabees. And they were referred to. I mean, it was, you know, there were a lot of books that weren't put into the canon, right? Like the Book of Jubilees and Book of, I mean, there were a lot that wasn't. But I think the traditional argument why it's not in the canon is because of this very violation, because they took on the mantle of political leadership when they were not, you know, weren't allowed to. And in fact, that the Pharisees, as they emerge, that's one of their, not just against the Maccabees, but they take a pretty strong party line that Jews really shouldn't have political leadership. There is a strong tradition, Pharisaic tradition, that it's better off for Jews just to live under somebody else's rule. It's not a... And often they would sort of send somebody, you know, saying basically, rule over us, like, stop it. We don't want to rule ourselves anymore. This is too crazy. I mean, I guess partly they had a very bad experience. But it is there is a sense that it's not good for the Jews for us to be ruling ourselves. We don't do it very well. There's too much, you know, fighting and factionalism. We should just concentrate on being good Jews and let somebody else do it. And that's one of the arguments I'll make here is that this bureaucratic mischief goes to that issue, and maybe I should get to that right now, which is, and this is then becomes one of the reasons why the Jews not only choose to rebel but are forced to rebel, and that is that when Cyrus becomes king, and the Jews are allowed to go rebuild, in the next generation of kings, probably by the time you get to, you know, Darius and Xerxes and certainly Artaxerxes, what happens is that the Jewish community that has been flourishing in Bavel, you know, and has gone through this whole sort of existential crisis and emerged stronger, right? And now it begins to look a little bit more like the Judaism we recognize. Which is that the crisis, of course, was, you know, how can you be a Jew when you're not in Judah and you don't have the Beit HaMikdash? So they have to answer that question during the first exilic period, and they do so, which is, you know, partly it was, well, God went with them into exile, but it also transformed Judaism into that you had religious leaders who were appointed and that these were the ones who were going to explain what Jewish law was, and that Jews were now going to have to follow sort of these rabbinic decisions. So how did we get there? So the Persians, when you're the empire, you can do whatever you want, right? So they could have made Persian law, the law of the entire land. But working with the Jews, and these were certainly influential Jews, and ones who had already thought about how Judaism is going to survive in a world now where we don't always have political autonomy, the Jews prevailed upon the Persians, and the Persians agreed to the following, which is that Jews in the Persian Empire would be subject to Jewish law. So basically, Persian law for Jews was Jewish law. And in so doing, they gave people like Ezra and the rabbis that he appoints, the interpreters, they gave them the power to determine what Jewish law was. So essentially what emerges in the Persian period, and then we see will continue for centuries up until the modern era, is that the Jewish community is granted religious autonomy as a community. The community gets to decide what is Jewish law for Jews, and here's the other thing, which is, you know, kind of interesting, which is, and Jews must obey Jewish law if they're to remain part of the community. So you have religious autonomy for the Jewish community. Now, on an individual level, and of course this is something that, you know, Baruch Spinoza spoke to, which is on an individual level, it does mean you sort of have religious coercion because the Jewish community is allowed to impose Jewish law on its members. But it gives the Jewish community religious autonomy within the context of a dominant empire. And this was what was so critical. This was the paradigm then that was going to allow for Jewish continuity. Otherwise, there was no way, because during the Persian period, the Jews were never going to, they weren't getting political autonomy back.
So yeah. Who and why caused this event to happen, namely Persian law for Jews or Jewish law? Was it Ezra?
It's Ezra, yeah.
Why and the control between him and Cyrus Persian?
Well, between Cyrus's successors, yeah. Probably Artaxerxes.
So open to this?
Okay, so why are the Persians so open to it? Because the Persians, what they want in the land of Israel, because this is now, because the Jews have gone back, and this is something that applies to that, to the land of Judah as well, they want stability. And they want something that works, and something that works for the people, and they're not interested in micromanaging people's lives, and they also want... And they were very tolerant people in that regard. They did not have this notion that they needed to impose their culture, their beliefs, their myths, gods on other people. So the Persians were sort of exceptional in that way, but it's established the template, which actually becomes the model for how Jews now live for the up until the modern era, until Napoleonic times, when all of a sudden Jews are emancipated and you can now be an individual Jew separate from the Jewish community. Up until that time, that's not how Jews lived. We lived subject to the Jewish, you know, the Jewish community had the authority to impose the law on its members. And then there was always the, you know, the certain tax had to be paid. And I mean, you had to buy off the authority. So it was pragmatic. But I don't think the Persians thought of it themselves. I think the Jewish community is the one that presented this idea to them. And they're like, okay, you know, yeah.
Practically speaking, though, if I'm a Jew and I have a dispute with a Persian who's living in the area, which law?
All right, so that's a good question. So that then if your dispute is with the Persian, you the Persian law is going to trump it. Because the Persian is never subject to Jewish law. Yeah, right, exactly. You still have to deal with the larger issue. But anything internal could be dealt with within the Jewish community.
So you really had to be very aware of Persian law.
Yes, yeah, you did. And there were interstices where they were certainly met, because you had to also, the Jewish leadership regularly would have to deal with the Persian leadership. But for the most part... Yeah, they were Zoroastrian, exactly. Although they, you know, Cyrus, he gives credit to Marduk, and so they were sort of, but Persians in general were Zoroastrians at that time. Yeah, their god is Ahura Mazda. It's like the Zoroastrian deity. Okay, so that continued from the time of Ezra. And when the Ptolemies then take over, right, when the Greeks conquer the Persians, so this tradition continued. And in fact, often it was the Jewish scribes who would write the document that basically gave them the official autonomy. And when the Seleucids came to power originally, they issued something that was known as the Charter of 200 now, because it was in the year 200, that basically, again, said the same thing. The Jews have their religious autonomy. Antiochus IV, then, what he does, besides outlawing, you know, what the religious persecution, it's all done within this a bureaucratic decree, which is he then, and at the encouragement of some of the, you know, very Hellenized Jews, he revokes the charter. And that, and says, you know, that's it, no more. Jews, you're just like everybody else. You don't have the special arrangement anymore. The whole principle of religious autonomy is I'm doing away with it. And that is what makes it so that the Jews, they have to rebel. Because without that special charter, and in such a hostile environment where you have not only this dominant Greek culture that's pressing on you, but where you have Greeks who are actively, you know, Antiochus was imposing it on you and specifically trying to destroy your culture. You know, there were times when people would revoke the charter, but they would look the other way, exactly. This wasn't one of those cases. He was revoking the charter, and he was staring down at you to make sure that you didn't practice anything. That's when the Jews finally had to say, okay, that's it. We can't, you know, you desecrate the Beit HaMikdash, maybe we can wait you out, but once you revoke the special status and revoke the principle of it, then we have to rebel. And so that's really, and I think that, you know, in this case, it was kind of obvious what he was doing. It was very targeted. It was a bureaucratic decision. He wasn't fooling anybody. But I also think we have to keep in mind, and I'll kind of end with this, I guess, which is that these bureaucratic maneuvers are something that people can try to pull all, like, it's something that people will pull on you, and in a lot of cases, they will couch it as something very different, pretending that, I mean, that it's not targeted at you specifically, that can wreak havoc on us. So, you know, just like the Jews during the Hanukkah story, I mean, they were very much aware of this, you know, it was a bureaucratic matter. It was basically a contract that was established between the Jewish community and the ruling empire that we had religious autonomy. And it was so essential to Jewish continuity that it had to be safeguarded. And so, and by the way, it's basically the way, as I said, the way that Jews then lived throughout the ages. You know, whether it was even under Christendom or under, you know, Islam, as they maintained this practice that was established during Persian times, just became, this is the way that Jews live within the larger community. So I got to thinking about, you know, bureaucratic maneuvers that are so, you know, targeted towards us, even though they're couched differently. And you can think about sort of these, nowadays the big thing, of course, is human rights. And so, you know, you see these in the UN, these you know, passing these bills all the time, targeting, you know, as sort of human rights legislation, right? And who can argue with human rights, right? We all believe in human rights. But in a way that it sort of targets Jews and targets Israel particularly. So they're passing sort of the, you know, these, you know, UN, whatever they're, can't think of the word, but resolutions, thank you. These UN resolutions that seem to be rather sort of, oh, it's just innocuous, you know, it's just human rights. Like, you know, again, who can argue with human rights? But again, trying to attack the very foundation, in this case, not of Jewish religious autonomy, but of the Jewish state. So that's become, you know, now that we have a Jewish state, it's you know, that becomes the target as opposed to Jewish religion.
But the UN army is laughable, and Antiochus had real forces to enforce what he wanted to do.
He did, but one of the reasons the Maccabees were able to succeed was that he was very busy elsewhere.
Well, could you talk talk a little more about?
Yeah, so you had...
How enforced, were there police all over, were there, you know, his soldiers, how active was the enforcement of, particularly the bans against Brit Milah or...
Right.
Or
so he set up, and this was something that the Jews despised, was he built a building in Jerusalem, it was called the Acra. And the Acra was essentially a fortress in Jerusalem. We don't know exactly where it is, but I think the best guess is it's actually right near where Al-Aqsa is now. And the reason we don't know where it is because when Herod expanded the Temple Mount, he kind of destroyed whatever had been of that building. So it's believed to have been there. And it was like a fortress in Jerusalem overlooking the Temple Mount, filled with the Syrian soldiers and ultimately with the Jewish supporters of the Syrians. And when the war broke out, that's where the Jewish supporters of the very Hellenized Jews actually hold up in the Acra, and that became the final fortress, you know, that
would overlook the whole city.
Oh yeah, overlooked particularly the Temple Mount. I mean, you overlooked the Beit HaMikdash, and you could overlook everything south was really easy to see, and you were high enough that you saw the whole western city as well. So they did have a pretty strong presence there. And in lots of other cities, you know, in the land of Israel. But Antiochus himself also got involved. A good chunk of his army was involved further to the east, in wars there. And ultimately, you know, it's because they're feeling pressure. I mean, you had the Parthians to the east, but also they were feeling a lot of pressure from Rome, because it's almost the time when Rome is going to take over. And in fact, one of the reasons Antiochus raided the treasury of the Beit Mikdash was he was actually forced to pay a huge tribute to Rome every year. So he had lost some of his independence also. So he was Rome was bothering him from the west. He had the Parthians in the east. South of him in Jerusalem, you had sort of this, sort of from his perspective, this kind of chaos. And it seemed, of course, that Israel was the easiest target, in the sense that this he should be able to control, because this is just a small nation, a small group of people. But it did require sort of way too many of his resources, and then he just got busy further to the east. So it wasn't, so the timing was a little beneficial to the Jews, in the sense that they didn't bring their entire army into Jerusalem at the time. And the Jews looked kind of favorably at the beginning at Rome and saw them as a bit of a savior, which had other consequences. That's for another day, I suppose. But yeah, that had other consequences. But then you have the Maccabees. Eventually, it takes about 20 years, but by 145, you have once again, for the first time in hundreds of years, Jewish sovereignty in Judah. It started off pretty small, but the Hashmonaim were very good warriors, very good political leaders, ruthless at times, and went on and saw themselves as in the legacy of Shlomo and David, or David and Shlomo, and so wanted to create sort of this greater Israel, and went on went on a campaign of territorial expansion, as well as increasing their numbers. And the way that to increase the number of Jews was, one, if you had a vibrant economy, Jews from other places would come. But number two was they embarked on a massive conversion project. And that's when the Idumeans became converts. And of course, you know, that's Herod kind of traces his heritage back to that. And all the other groups were in the land of Israel were sort of given the ultimatum of convert, die, or leave. That was sort of your choice. So the number of Jews actually went up significantly, and the amount of territory that was under Jewish control went up. So it was a pretty successful time until Rome just became too overwhelming. And there was a lot of, and they were, especially by the time Yeah, at the end, there was a lot of infighting among them by the end. And one of the great ironies, of course, of it all, and this, is that the Chashmonaim ended up becoming big embracers of Greek culture. So if you compare the coins, even, I didn't bring a picture, but if you see the coins from the earlier Chashmonaim versus the later ones, the earlier ones will have their inscription in Hebrew, their name. Later, in the 40 years later, you'll see a one side it has it in Hebrew, and on the other side it's in Greek. And then by the end, the coins are just in Greek. But they did embrace lots of aspects of Hellenistic culture. So it is that may be another reason why not to include them in the canon, because of becoming kind of very, very Greek, building, mausoleums for themselves, lots of living an extremely, affluent lifestyle. They built a huge palace in Jerusalem. And then they fought among themselves. So it didn't last, unfortunately.
It was a major black mark, this forced conversion. Was it Yohanan Hyrcanus?
Yeah.
This is like a major blemish in our Jewish history as far as some historians.
Yeah, I guess it depends on how you view conversions,
Well,
I mean,
on the edge of a knife.
Yeah, right. So it's not very nice. Yeah, I agree. The other thing is, he's the one who destroyed, the Samaritans had built a temple on Har Gerizim, and he, destroyed that temple. Because this was part of his, he did not force the Samaritans to convert, because I guess they were considered sort of like they weren't Jews, obviously, but they were sort of whatever. He let them sort of be as Samaritans, but he destroyed their temple. It is a bit of a... I mean, they were kind of fanatics. They were. There was no question about it. But it was essential to them to sort of get back sort of this political autonomy. I mean, what they wanted was religious autonomy. But because of the fact that they were actually able to, after 20 years, kind of defeat the Greeks, which I don't think they set out to at the beginning, meaning it was a rebellion to really just restore what they had before. That was the original goal. But then it kind of turned into be more successful than they thought, and all of a sudden now they're ruling their own nation, and the Syrian Greeks are just gone. And the Syrian Greeks they're declining. And so I don't think their original intent was to become these sort of priest kings. Instead, it just kind of happened. And then once they had achieved the victory, they weren't going to give up the power. Meaning what they, I guess from the Jewish perspective, what they should have done is gone back to being Kohanim and let somebody else from the community become the rulers. But that's pretty hard to do after you fought a war for 20 years and you were the leaders and everybody kind of recognizes you at that. And then they became they became corrupted by the power. But there is, I think, I mean, look, look, the YU sports team, we're the Maccabees, so the Macs. So there's a certain pride in this today. But if you look at the details, right, sometimes it's not 100% glory.
Now, you mentioned when I came in that it's tradition is for Jewish people not to go on the Temple Mount, but I don't know that everyone holds that. Maybe certain parts of the Temple Mount.
Oh, okay.
Taboo.
So that's actually a more right. So, the Jewish tradition was that on the Temple Mount there were these areas of increasing exclusivity, right? So our Jewish tradition is like in the Beit HaMikdash, like only the Kohen Gadol is allowed to, and the Holy of like that, and you can only go there once a year. So, and in fact, later on, when even the Jews were fighting the Romans on the Temple Mount, that our tradition is that only the Kohanim would fight in the temple area, and the Israel would make sure that they stayed. And so they were kind of like hopping around, making sure if you were just a regular, Israelite, you were not going into the area where you can.
Which is maybe probably where El Aqsa is.
No. The Dome of the Rock.
I'm sorry, Temple Mount.
Yeah.
That's but every place else is
so and even after the Second Temple was destroyed in the Byzantine era, I mean, Jews would go up to the Temple Mount. Then it became our practice not to. We imposed it on ourselves. They sometimes imposed it on us as well, but we imposed it on ourselves not to go up there at all because of the possible violations of sanctity. But yeah, I know I've heard now that Jews go up there, Orthodox Jews go up there, and as long as you know where the... Because Herod expanded it quite a bit. The Temple Mount is at least double the size as it was originally during the First Temple period. So all the parts that he expanded... You know, the logic is you don't have to worry about violating the sanctity of the place because the southern part was just fill that he dumped in and expanded the platform. The northern part was he graded it and built up some new things. So where Al-Aqsa Mosque is, that area around that is all on land that Herod filled in order to create a larger platform. So that area, you know, so if you kind of go in the southern part, and then just kind of like, you know, you could go the eastern part on the edge. I mean, I'm not giving Pesach here, but and then the northern part also where he added on, it seems like you should be in pretty safe territory.
The circumference is...
the circumference is fine, yeah. Because he added on all of that, except the eastern border is the same one. But we know that the sanctity did not go all the way to the edge of the platform. So check your local rabbi where you can go. But yeah, the Temple Mount, but where the Dome of the Rock is, that is the rock in the Dome of the Rock is believed to be, you know, the part that was in the Dvir, in the Holy of Holies. So you should not go there.
The second issue is that everyone says, well, the entire Temple Mount is off limits, and this whole issue of Jews going up there, that incited the Arabs.
Okay, but that's a separate issue.
They're saying the Jews are violating the Kodesh rules. So,
oh, okay.
So it's they brought it upon themselves because they were over this law of not walking on Temple Mount, but it's allowed. So
yes, it technically maybe it is allowed. On the other hand, you know, just the Temple Mount has always been like a powder keg. I mean, it's from you go back to the time of the Hashmonaim, you go back to the time of the Romans. I mean, you have Jesus up there on the Temple Mount saying it's going to be destroyed. Da da da. I mean, it's a powder keg up there. And so when Jews today go up there because they want to daven up there, that is provocative. That, I mean, let's not pretend that they're just going up there because why not? I mean, the Muslims today view that the Muslims in a lot of ways are powerless in Israel, and this is their one area where they have authority, and they are very zealous in protecting that authority. So, yes, technically Jews can go up there, and if you want to go up as a tourist and, you know, wear your baseball cap or whatever and just kind of walk around and see what it is, you know, bavakasha. But you know, the idea, like going up there to daven, that is provocative. Like, let's not pretend it's not. You know, and is it really the best time to do that right now? I don't know. People have different opinions, but you are definitely stirring something up by going up there. And so you have to ask yourself whether or not you want to do that right now. But you can certainly go up there, you know, and just kind of, you know, non-Muslims are allowed on the Temple Mount. That's the you just walk up, you know, the thing that's in the women's section, that's the entryway. You go right up there. That's how non-Muslims. But from my understanding is they don't allow anyone in the Dome of the Rock anymore that's not Muslim. So that's not even going to happen for you, if you wanted to. Only Muslims.
Uh-huh.
Right. No tourists. Non-Muslims are not allowed. I mean, that may change, but right now, for the last number of years, they have prohibited that.
The tabernacle in Salt Lake City.
Exactly, right. You can't, that's right. You can see from the outside, but you can't go inside, right. All right, so well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Kavi, for being here.
Sure.
And for everybody else, we have